Let's handle a few more objections to panpsychism. Pan-niftyism. Pan-niftyism is Dan Dennett's reductio ad absurdum of panpsychism. It comes in various forms, and it's one of the most common objections raised. It cuts to the heart of the issue of emergence. Is consciousness like chairness or cellness, in that it's reducible to component parts? Is the fact that it's like something to be irreducible? Or is it something that can be broken down into component parts, like chairs and cells?
According to panpsychism, bacteria are conscious, proteins are conscious, carbon atoms are consciousness, even photons are a little bit conscious. Here's another view, pan-niftyism. Everything is nifty. Electrons are nifty. Photons are nifty. Molecules are nifty. Pan-niftyism. How does panpsychism differ from pan-niftyism? There's no difference.
So niftiness and phenomenal properties of consciousness are simply not analogous. I would accept a weak emergentist account of niftiness, just like cells or tables and chairs. I wouldn't say niftiness is a new ingredient being added any more than chairness or cellness. Dennett's objection is that it seems absurd to explain the existence of niftiness by saying everything is nifty. And of course it is. But I think there are important differences between niftiness and consciousness. There's nothing irreducible about niftiness. If you define nifty as something cool or useful, perhaps in a surprising way, just like that, we've reduced niftiness to a collection of parts that are not by themselves nifty. Consciousness, on the other hand, seems to have some irreducibly qualitative aspect, arranging matter for which it's not like anything to be, and developing into matter for which it's suddenly like something, seems like an example of strong emergence. I don't think strong emergence is possible. Very few people do. I don't think there are further constituents to matter that are undiscovered, at least relevant to this issue. So the only option I seem to be left with is that there are further properties of the matter that we already know about. Mysterianism. Though I've argued that we're led to panpsychism if we accept certain premises, the whole project of trying to make sense of consciousness assumes that we can make rational sense of it. The rational intelligibility of the universe, to the human mind, is not the craziest assumption in the world we could make, but it's possible to question. Mysterianism feels a little fatalistic, but it's undeniably true on some level. There are times when our intuitions simply hit a wall, and consciousness could be one of those times. We may never get an intuitively satisfying answer to certain questions. We'll never have an intuitively satisfying answer to whether the universe is infinite or finite, for example. Both possibilities seem equally hard to imagine concretely. There are no doubt examples of facts that are not graspable because of the natural constraints of the human brain. Why would we expect anything else, given who we are and how we got here? Our intuitions evolved to help us survive and reproduce as social animals. They're great for Newtonian physics and detecting social cues. They're mostly trustworthy within their domains, but our minds did not emerge so we could be able to understand fundamental questions about the universe. The philosopher Noam Chomsky has claimed that the basic insight of Mysterianism is essentially a truism. If you believe human beings are a part of the natural world, it would be crazy to think we could understand everything there is to know. Why would mental properties be any different from physical properties if you're a naturalist and a physicalist? Wings have limitations, eyes have limitations, but our minds don't. Non-human animals don't have the knowledge we do, and they don't even know they're missing out on something. Who is arrogant enough to say humans are somehow exempt from this? The problem, however, with playing the Mysterianism card is that there is no circumstance in which you're not allowed to play that card. For any obstacle we hit, any setback, any confusion, Mysterianism can be invoked to explain the confusion. The basic insight of Mysterianism is undoubtedly true, but we must be wary of using it as an argument, since it can halt any investigation, even if the searching would have borne fruit if we hadn't given up. There have been plenty of times in scientific history that a problem seemed intractable, and a Mysterian in the room could have brought down the whole project, and they could have done so without being wrong about anything they said. So we have to be careful about appealing to Mysterianism to halt an investigation. We're trapped in this horrible position of knowing Mysterianism is basically true, that our minds are unable to comprehend the right answers to certain questions, or even the right questions to begin with. But we can't let it inform our actions because we'll just throw up our hands and invoke Mysterianism whenever we hit an obstacle. There are parts of the universe our minds can comprehend, and we won't know which are which until we really investigate them. So we have to assume everything is comprehensible until we have good reason to think otherwise, or else we'll simply never make any progress. Our minds may not have evolved to understand everything in the universe, but they did evolve to give us accurate information about the parts of the universe relevant to us. So the rational intelligibility of the universe isn't a crazy thing to believe in. Plus, we have the enormous empirical success of the sciences to ensure us that there is value in accepting the rational intelligibility of the universe and proceeding. For whatever reason, much of the universe is rationally intelligible to us. So to sum up, I'm fine with recognizing the truth of Mysterianism in a conversation about Mysterianism, but I would be unlikely to accept it as a legitimate move in a discussion. I think there's value in seeing where our reason leads us. Here are a few that aren't objections exactly, but things that commonly come up. Doesn't panpsychism sound like New Agey, spiritualist, pseudoscientific, quantum woo, Deepak Chopra stuff? I think this reaction is due largely to the word panpsychism. Pan means all, and psyche means soul. It's an exotic sounding name, but we could call it with equal accuracy pan-experientialism. It's just the idea that matter is experience involving. But I think I agree with Annika Harris that the name is a liability. It sounds pseudoscientific. And it can attract the wrong kind of person, like Rupert Sheldrake. He's not someone I would ever want to be associated with, but he's taken it upon himself to publicly defend panpsychism, which is too bad for panpsychism. If Sheldrake wants to help panpsychism gain acceptance, the best thing he can do for panpsychism is never talk about it again, or publicly oppose it. But panpsychism is only regarded as woo by its opponents who don't understand it very well. It's a perfectly respectable position to hold in philosophy of mind. Take it from Keith Frankish, outspoken materialist and opponent of panpsychism. Quote, "Panpsychism might sound like New Age mysticism, but some hard-nosed analytic philosophers have suggested it might be how things are, and it's now a hot topic in philosophy of mind." End quote. If we want to convince other skeptical, scientifically oriented people, we shouldn't actively scare them off with the label. Harris, in her book Conscious, invites readers to try to come up with a better name. Some have taken up Russellian monism, since Bertrand Russell's neutral monism sounds fairly panpsychist. And it never hurts to invoke Russell. According to panpsychism, is the chair I'm sitting on conscious? So the answer is no. The chair you're sitting on is not a subjective experience according to panpsychism. Panpsychists argue that all the particles that make it up may have to be. To quote the philosopher Hedda Hassel-Merck, panpsychists usually don't take tables and other artifacts to be conscious as a whole. Rather, the table could be understood as a collection of particles that each have their own very simple form of consciousness. End quote. It also bears repeating that consciousness, the fact that it's like something to be, should not be conflated with intelligence, self-consciousness, language, memory, or any of the things that are far too often conflated with consciousness. Why can't we stay on the paradigm we've been working on? Won't science eventually solve consciousness? Panpsychism doesn't require that we throw out the paradigm we've been working on. It's not an anti-science view. To be honest, it's hard for me to imagine how our scientific projects would change if panpsychism becomes widely accepted. I suppose there will be a lot more interest in Giulio Tononi's integrated information theory, IIT, but other than that, I'm not sure. The bottom line is that science is unable to answer every question we have about consciousness. There can be a science of consciousness. It just won't answer every question we have about consciousness. That's what Chalmers was trying to bring attention to with his easy problem, hard problem distinction.
That, can't be done and will never be done, simply because science has to produce publicly checkable results, has to be, is as it were, essentially a third-person enterprise. I could never know for certain that an electron has experiential being. Science cannot evolve a vocabulary which includes experiential predicates. What I mean is it cannot have terms for experiential features because they are essentially private and they're not possibly publicly observable. I can never know what kind of colour you're observing right now. In fact, strictly speaking, I can't even know that you have a mind at all. It's simply not a possible object of knowledge for the natural sciences.
This doesn't necessarily mean that we change how we do science. It just means it's not the whole story. Physical science is simply not designed to deal with the subjective qualities of consciousness. Neuroscience can tell us about the neural correlates of consciousness. It can tell us which brain states correlate with particular states of consciousness. But some questions are distinctly philosophical questions, and that doesn't mean they're meaningless or not worth thinking about. Our answer to the mind-body problem will not only change how we think about consciousness, it'll influence many other fields in unpredictable ways that will only reveal themselves as new paradigms gain acceptance. The widespread adoption of panpsychism could influence our views of causation or the possibility of natural teleology, to name two examples that have been postulated. Hedda Hassel-Merk has argued that mysteries surrounding causation, originally raised by Hume, can be resolved through accepting panpsychism. So I'm working on an episode on the combination problem, which is widely considered to be the most important objection to panpsychism. And once we cover that, I think that'll wrap it up for panpsychism. I'm sure it'll crop up now and then, but the main series will be over, since I've said pretty much everything I wanted to say. I think collectively, it will have been a few hours on panpsychism. I really enjoyed it, and it's been a long time coming. Even if you're not convinced, hopefully you understand it a little more. It's a view that's gaining popularity every day, so it's definitely worth knowing something about. All right, thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.